Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hi, I'm Nick Slater.
Hi, I'm Lanx.
Together with Shades of Rhythm, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hi everyone, and welcome to a brand new episode in Season 2 of the House Culture Podcast. I'm your host and the Managing Editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. Feels great to be talking to you live and direct and providing a taste of much-missed clubland for your ears. Stay strong, people. We will all dance together again one day soon. I want to thank everybody who has got in touch and given us some incredible feedback on this second season. Please drop us a note if you haven't already. During this season, we have featured chats with Fatboy Slim himself, Norman Cook, icon of Ibiza, Dawn Hindle, Big Man, Tall Ball, Melon Bomber, Scott Gray, legendary promoter and DJ, Dave Jones, one half of cheeky old school rave outfit, Alternate, Mark Archer, Pike's Hotel resident DJ, Paul Linney, Shoom's Fengali and house music originator, Danny Rampling, New Jersey's finest DJ and producer, Harry Romero, plus many more. Well, as some even bigger names to come. And if you haven't done so already, get crate digging through our equally impressive back catalogue from Season 1. In there you'll find conversations with scenesters such as Danny Clockwork, John Satrencher, Greg Wilson and Sally Rogers from A Man Called Adam. Also, if you've only just discovered this podcast and are wondering what house culture is all about, our credo is that we are a collective of house music fans who have come together through our mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. We're on Instagram at houseculturenet, so come and join us on the virtual dance floor there, where we can come together to support and nurture this beautiful scene. Let's get moving with this episode, shall we? In this one, we chat to an iconic group who are not only from the old school, but also from my birthplace of Peterborough. Oh yes, it can only be Nick Slater and Lanx from Shades of Rhythm. In the interview, we'll hear how they created some of their iconic tracks and promoted them all by themselves.
We started just messing about on the keyboards and samplers, and within literally half an hour, we'd done Sweet Sensation. So we were like, we've got to squeeze this on this album. We literally bunged it in the back of our car. We had 1,000 copies. Our mate did the artwork, and we went to the record shops that we were shopping at, took a box of 30 in. You know, the relief when he said, yeah, I like that, I'll take 30.
How scary it was for them when they decided to become full-time musicians.
So we spoke to Nick's mum and dad in the kitchen. We said, we're thinking about giving up our work, you know, we're sort of getting offered money to like do gigs and this sort of stuff. And then what your mum said to me, like, oh, you don't want to do that. Like, you know, you want to get a proper job and you want to make sure you've got constant money coming in. He was like, okay. Looked at Nick's dad. He was like, you go for it.
And their experiences across the rave scene in general.
And then you'd hear, oh, there's a rave in Cambridge. Everybody in the cars. Everybody go to Cambridge. You don't know what you're doing. I remember once we drove an hour to Cambridge, waited 2 hours in the car park. First car pulls out. We start following it all down these country roads. 2 hours later, we're back in Peterborough. the rave's here. So like 5 hours later, we're back where we started.
Now, this interview was recorded during lockdown, outside and at a social distance. So I hope you also enjoy the general Peterborough park life you can hear in the background. So let's take a journey back to the old school and hear from the sweet sensations that are Shades of Rhythm.
House culture.
Guys, thanks for taking the time out to sit down with me on this beautiful day.
Just turned into it, yeah.
You're one of the iconic acts from the old school era and produced numerous tracks that have gone on to become anthems within the scene. Before we chat about that, we always like to start at the very beginning. And can you tell us about your experiences with music, kind of growing up, and how you discovered your love for music and repetitive beats?
Yeah. So me and Lance went to school together in a little town called Wilsey. And we ended up in a band together. I was drumming, Lance was playing keys, and we were just doing cover versions of all kinds of tunes that we probably shouldn't even mention now. It wasn't our band, so we were kind of like the musicians in a band, really. So we didn't have much control over the material we were playing. And I think the biggest game changer for us was back then, the school, every single Friday, used to have a school disco. So we were like 13 years old, and we were, every Friday, obviously you'd look forward to that at school. It was like the highlight of the week. It's every Friday dinner time, you'd go down to the hall and there'd be like a disco. And the guys playing were really into their jazz funk, into their soul.
So who were these guys playing? Were they students at the school?
They were fifth years, yeah, as it were then, in old money. So it was kind of like an education for us anyway. Likewise, the youth club then, we used to go down to the youth club, and where they're playing like Dex's Midnight Runners in one room and it's packed out, you'd have the back room with, you know,
Lowell and Dave playing soul, jazz, funk.
Lowell and Dave, Rob Jones,
yeah, Steve Walsh. Not
the London Steve Walsh, but we had our own here. And they kind of educated us into soul music and then what became electro funk. And
so we got into the all-dayers and the weekenders,
yeah,
didn't we? And soul funk. And then, like you say, electro funk and Jack House.
Yeah.
Was starting to sort of catch on, and we was just addicted to that. We used to buy records from there as well, didn't we? So we used to have US imports.
I mean, because we were the only kids into their music, they kind of took us under their wings a little bit, and because they were like 3 or 4 years older than us, and they'd be like, "Oh, we're going record shopping in London on Sunday. Do you want to come?" And we was like, "Yeah." so we'd all, every Sunday we'd go down to secondhand record shops, and they'll be just like going through, and I mean me, I'd be like, I don't know any of this stuff at like 15 years old probably.
You're looking at the covers,
or the titles
of the albums.
But they were literally like, you want that, yeah, you want that, yeah, you want that.
Oh, that's amazing.
And you know, I'd get home, and that's when our learning begun, really, wasn't it? So
yeah, and then later that would be the catalyst for creating music,
because they were like big tunes, and we were drawing on that and mixing it with the hip hop that we were probably into and they weren't into. So I think that's kind of what led us on to being at the forefront at the beginning of the rave, I think, because we were experimenting.
Yeah,
we were nerds.
Yeah,
we were sort of into the equipment as well.
Well, I think you have to be a kind of nerd as well, in a way, like, so just to kind of cherry pick those samples and to have that background already. It's a great grounding. You know, it's almost like that rave era chopping up samples. It's almost like a UK version of American hip hop. Just kind of, you know, there was a UK hip hop where they'd be chopping up samples, but, you know, taking that further to the next level. If you've already got that grounding in like the jazz funk kind of scene.
Yeah, we had a lot to draw off, didn't we? So a lot of the time, you know, when you're not feeling musically creative, you're literally like taking a record out of your record collection, putting it on, letting it play through, or skipping through, looking at the vinyl to see where the light gaps are, and then just sampling, all day sampling. And then you have to go through all your samples and you have to truncate them and put them in 4-bar, 2-bar loops, whatever. And then, you know, a few weeks later, when you're feeling the creative process, then we'd have that folder of loops, fresh loops, to draw on.
So, what equipment were you using for this back then?
Well, when we started, we were literally... Because, I mean, me and Lance were kind of in a band to start with. And then with the soul scene, especially in Peterborough where we were, in the soul scene, there was kind of breakdancing and rap competitions. And me and Lance, I used to scratch, Lance used to rap, and... We were in one crew. We had a great crew, and Rayan, our singer.
What was the crew called?
I think it was Catch Crew, weren't it? But there was a massive Catch Crew, so we was probably just, I don't know, we were like 15, 16, just with our lino down on the paddling pool in the Manor Leisure Centre. But yeah, we...
I think we started DJing first, didn't we? So yeah. Our first purchase would have probably been like a really old belt-driven
deck.
Double decks.
Because we progressed to the school disco Friday DJs, you see. So
And then we'd have to buy amps, and then we'd buy speakers, and then I think eventually we sort of started getting into buying keyboards and sequencers and drum machines.
Yeah, but I remember we used to practice in a television workshop on a Sunday, so every Sunday was rehearsal day. And this was like 1986. Never dreamt of, you know... succeeding. It was just, we enjoyed it, that was it. We'd just turn up and I'd literally have all these soul records and hip-hop records on turntables, and we'd be looping those, and Lance would have just one keyboard that had like about a 1 second sample memory on it,
and the Technics 12 or 24 band equalizer.
Yeah,
we used to have it running of the output of the mix. We used to get the channels and we used to go because we didn't have any other music to generate those kind of sounds.
No, one keyboard, equaliser, microphone, and a set deck. Yeah, that was it. Not that point. That was like probably 2 years later.
Yeah, straight on cassette.
So, that's literally the equipment we had. And then because we were working, literally, it was like a case of waiting 3 months till you got enough money to go across the road at Music Village, and then we'd start buying one bit of equipment at a time. I remember Rayan actually won the football pools, didn't he?
Yeah.
At one point, and so that got us a Juno 2 keyboard.
Yeah.
Which was probably our first step into proper equipment.
Yeah.
You know. So he only won about £400, but to us then that was like winning a million.
Yeah. So in terms of drawing that inspiration, not only was it like you said, you mentioned the Weekender events and stuff like that, so you're already kind of going to events and getting inspiration and seeing big DJs at the time and acts at the time play.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean the Old Dares were legendary. I mean they were buses basically that went to London, Birmingham, Nottingham, Leicester, and you know, you'd get on about midday, meet at the Key Theatre, get on a bus. All like-minded people, you know, everybody's got like a sports bag with them. First time I went, I was like, we're not going away, are we? Why's everybody got a sports bag? And they're the change of clothing that, you know, you walk in a club, you just put your sports bag down on the ground, and they were like several sets of clothing that you'd change into throughout the sweating process of the all day. But I mean, those were really the moments that kind of shaped it, really. I remember, because it was very soul-y jazz funk, and then one day we went, I think it was Powerhouse.
Oh, yeah.
In Birmingham.
Oh, yeah.
And all of a sudden, it frightened me to death, but it was sub-bass for the first time that we'd heard.
The Pac-Man. You know? Yeah, he was walking through the crowd, and it literally took your breath away. And we was like, we're just used to soul funk, like, from the start of it. And then all of a sudden, this sound comes along. People talk about the rave era sort of being creative of new sounds, but fidelity wise the first electro records, they were using the same studios and the same mixers that they'd been using for years, like the 70s and the 80s, and the sound was so pristine and well mixed, it's almost unbeatable.
it's kind of been lost really, hasn't it, that sound?
Yeah, it kind of came back in dubstep, but then obviously very glitchy. Those old tracks, you know, Hashim, El Nafish, loads of them, Captain Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they can still work a system and a dance floor now, those tracks. They've got it all going on.
Yeah. From then we kind of got together with Rayan, who was in another rap crew, and said, do you want to form a band? And there was four of us back then. So there was Wildcat as well, who now lives on a little island in the Caribbean.
Nice.
Got a little studio there.
Barbados.
Yeah. Records John Cleese's voiceovers every now and then. So, but yeah, there was four of us then. He was really into his acid house. So he was kind of, he was the godfather of acid house in Peterborough. You know.
Yeah, he was. Yeah.
So he was bringing that sound into you guys, or were you already kind of aware of that?
We was all into it.
We was already jacking, yeah. We were jacking. Because we used to put on parties as well. And illegal radio stations for a while. And it was that time when, you know, you'd have a soul club sold out on a Sunday night in Peterborough, you know, rammed, completely rammed. And then up the road, you'd have another club and they just started playing house music and that was completely empty, you know. But we were the ones who kind of moved across the road from the soul club and started jacking in the empty house club until it eventually got bigger and bigger. Yeah. And then they swapped over, you know. So we were just looking, anything technology based we were interested in.
Yeah, I think at the very start of it, when we wrote the tracks for our first album, we would have had Roland Juno 2, Rayan had, and then I had a 909, and we had a
106.
Juno 106,
yeah.
And maybe a S10 sampler?
Yeah, Roland S10 sampler.
Yeah, and I had a sampler, S330 sampler, and that was it.
All of the classic bits of kit.
Yeah, so, you know, every song's probably can be made up of four or five elements, can't it? So we were away, had our samples, 8 seconds of memory.
Basically, we just decided we wanted to record a record. So we looked in the Yellow Pages to the closest studio to us, and it was in Biggleswade, probably about 45 minutes away from us. So we booked it up for 2 days, Saturday and Sunday. Went down there, and the guy who owned the studio turned out to be a guy called Steve Vincent, who was in a jazz funk band called Touchdown.
Yeah.
And Touchdown was a massive record for us. You know, we used to go out and party to that all day. And so once we found that out, we was like, well, you know, this guy is serious, you know. So we ended up recording 3 tracks at his studio. And then by the end of the Sunday night, he said, I've just started a label. Do you want to sign this to it? Do you want to put it out?
He recognised how good it was and the way the sound was moving from the jazz funk stuff towards this more...
This was about 1987, so there was house stuff about, but it was kind of American house-based stuff. Then you had kind of the more poppy, cold-cutty, charty stuff that was had an influence from that housey stuff, which, I mean, cold-cut now, just amazing, the stuff they're doing at the moment. But, yeah, so that was about 1986, 87. It must have been 87. And it was a house track that sampled jazz funk tracks on one side, a soul track, and then on the A side was a full-on kind of breakbeaty, ravey, housey beat that, funny enough, sampled Hashish.
Hashim. Hashish.
Got my head somewhere else there. And so we signed to him, and he said, right, we're going to go do a Scottish tour. We're like, what? We've never played live before.
I know.
So he said, yeah, we're doing 7 gigs on the Saturday.
What?
And 8 gigs on the Sunday.
Wow.
I think we was only doing like 5 on the Friday, something like that. So
there's a lot of gigs.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Kind of timings were they? Was that like across the whole day, or was that like just one evening?
No, it was just 7 until sort of One or two in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. 7 till 2. Yeah. Yeah. Literally, he drove us to Scotland. It was like snowing. Like, it was terrible weather. Yeah, he picked us up, and we were literally doing one track. So it was like go in there, play the track, perform it. Rain was singing. I think you had a guitar.
I did. Yeah, for the first one. I didn't know.
So I was on the deck, like scratching, and we'd literally go in, do it out. Next one, go in, do it out. So we was doing all these Glasgow clubs, like Timpan Alley and stuff like that.
What was the reaction to that kind of stuff at that time? Did people get it?
Not good at all. No, it's like
it was terrible.
It was.
I was exploited by the Ras Club beatbox label. If you look at their first album, on the reverse, it's got a ripped page that's got some of Ryan's lyrics on it.
Yeah. It's so his frequency, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So he's slagging off Beatbox Records because they just took the absolute piss. Yeah. So from that moment on, we just did everything ourselves after that.
Yeah. Yeah, it turns out to be Stevie V who did Dirty Cash, Steve Vincent. So a couple of years later, he was releasing stuff.
We inspired him to get a bit more in touch with his sampling when we went in his studio, so he didn't have a clue.
No, he had an 808 and we was like, what?
Yeah, he was in the mic booth like playing on his 808.
And then we realised we was paying 20 quid an hour for it.
So on from that, you wouldn't class that as kind of your big break then?
It was quite important though, because when we signed to him, thinking, yeah, record deal, let's sign. Wildcat, the fourth member, Colin, he didn't sign. He didn't want to give any of his music to anybody else. So it was kind of a split, really. That's when we split and went to three people. So it's quite early on. We've always stayed friends and always see him and still chat. And, you know, he's super talented. And we worked with him on a few projects that he's been doing early on as well. So that was quite pivotal, and then we just decided we want to do an album on our own. We want to release it on our own. So we started putting all our tracks together, and the way we work, one of us would come up with a demo, we'd play it to other people, and then if they like it, then we'd all jump on board. And in that month we had to record the album, we started producing all the tracks that we'd chosen for the album. Most of the tracks were recorded in that month, and then literally we finished the last track on a Saturday about dinner time. And it'd been a bit, because we'd never really mixed anything before, so it'd kind of been quite hard for us to mix this album. So it was kind of a release after that, and we literally had all the samples still loaded from tracks like Exorcist and Homicide that we recorded, and because the pressure was off and the release of finishing and that final recording of on that, we started just messing about on the keyboards and samplers, and within literally half an hour we'd done Sweet Sensation. Within that half an hour, so we were like, shit, we've got to put this on here. We've got to squeeze this on this album. And there was already 9 tracks on the album at that point. So, you know, you can imagine how quiet it's going to be, you know, 9 tracks on an album. We didn't even think about that at the time. We were just like, we could get another one on here, you know. So yeah, that's how Sweet Sensation came about, which kind of was a track that launched us.
Yeah.
So it's mad that if we just walked out at that point, none of this probably would have happened, or it would have been a lot longer happening. But just, it's that mindset of getting in your head in the right place rather than having it like a job to do. It totally changed it. And we were just like, I mean, even one of the keyboard riffs is literally, Ryan don't play keys, and one of the keyboard riffs is literally Ryan going, drum, drum, like with his finger on there, and it's
like,
just,
yeah, sounds good, do it again,
record it. It's just, and like within half an hour it just all come together. Which I guess a lot of good tracks do. They're not a struggle, are they?
I think, yeah, just having that creativity and just messing around, and you have those happy accidents, don't you?
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we kind of fast forward to now in terms of thinking like producing, it's almost too many options. It's almost like having that limitation when you guys started out is more create, you're more creative within that.
Yeah, you've got less things to clog your head. So you really get in depth with each piece of equipment, which is great. You get an idea, you know, exactly how to execute it. But then on the other side, you know, no internet, not even thought of at that point. And then, you know, how do you get rid of a buzzing mains lead? What's phase? You know, and all that sort of stuff. And compressors, we didn't know what a compressor was or a limiter. And if we did, we still struggled with it, didn't we? Because you needed a limiter and compressor on every channel. You ain't got that kind of money.
I remember buying my first limiter, first compressor, and getting it back and going, well, I've got a compressor. Evidently, this is what you need. And I remember switching it on and going,
put it straight across the
output. It's not doing anything.
Threshold down, ratio up.
That's it. You just get it and you just play around with it until you get it to do what you want it to do.
Yeah, but you're right, there's no limit. So whereas we had a limit of, well, at one point, you know, 4 seconds samples was our limit, and then you'd have to stop. That was the cut-off point. Because I think, you know, as artists, you're never really happy with it. There's always something else you can do with it. But that used to give you that, that's it, we've reached our limit here. So that's the track. Yeah. Whereas, like you say, now, you've got hard drives full of space and full of libraries, and it's so hard to... to say, that's it. Yeah. We'll stop here.
Especially, like you say, if you're not, you got to do it when almost you're not completely happy with it either. It's like you keep tinkering, and it will never get out there if you.
And you can so easily just lose that one thing that was special in the first place. Yeah.
So I mean, sweet. So you mentioned Sweet Sensations kind of like launched you onto that platform, and did that lead to playing at such events? Like, I mean, you've played at like Fantasia, Rain Dance, like all those early 90s huge
I think when we
events.
Released Frequency, you know, we was thinking on our edge then, businessmen, and we put a mobile number on the back of the album. And then once we'd peddled that around Manchester and London, like sort of the following week, we were starting to get phone calls from distributors who wanted to more of the record. But also we got our first gig invite.
Was it Astoria? Yeah.
What about Subterranea?
Was that Subterranea after? Was slightly after that. Yeah, but yeah, so it was that introduction to London. Basically, we put out the Frequency album, and then we literally bunged it in the back of our car. We had 1,000 copies. Our mate did the artwork. And we went to the record shops that we were shopping at, because every Saturday we'd be going down to London, going down to Nottingham, going down to up to Manchester, and buying records to play out, because we were DJing gigs, albeit Thursday nights, because, you know, back then it was commercial in clubs on Fridays and Saturdays, you know. So if you was into dance music, you'd have to go on a Sunday or a Thursday, and, you know, that's when the scenes kind of started. But so we kind of knew a few record shops, and we took it down there on a Saturday morning, drove down, took a box of 30 in, let them play it, which was nerve-wracking, you know. Imagine
hearing your material in the shop that you've been buying stuff from.
Not only them, who have got ears to the best music in the whole world every week dropping, but also the people in their shops, which, you know, you got Stu Allen, Graham Parks, you know, you got all these DJs who are buying ready for their set that night, you know. And you can see them, you know, it was just so
nerve-wracking. We were timid country boys.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we was just into it. Just,
and it was, you know, the relief when he said, yeah, I like that, I'll take 30, but it's got to be sale or return. So,
and what kind of cut were you getting from that at the time?
I think it worked out about a quid a record, something like that, we were getting.
Really?
Yeah, it weren't a lot. It was covering our expenses.
Oh, well, yeah, I didn't think about the expenses.
Yeah. No, we did, that was a problem.
We only sold 1,000, and we thought that was great, and we would have sold more, but then somebody bootlegged it.
Oh no.
And they probably sold 10,000.
Yeah.
Just put it on a white label, but we was happy, you know, did its job.
It's ultimate flattery, isn't it, if someone's going to bootleg it. I suppose that's shit for you guys in terms of getting revenue from it, but it's still getting you out there.
But the pirate radio stations started playing Exorcist, Homicide and Sweet Sensation, which were the three tracks that kind of off the album that people went for. And because they were doing that, then they wanted us to go and perform it. So that was kind of the introduction. And then because we started performing it, it got interest of record labels. So we had quite a few major labels ringing us up, which was like, I mean, I was working at BT, climbing telegraph poles at the time, and he was at Red Ring, Hot Point, wherever, and, you know. So all of a sudden, we were at that point where it was like, we're going to have to quit work here. And
Spoke to Nick's mum and dad in the kitchen. Like, Nick's mum and dad, me, Nick and Rayan, was like, we're thinking about giving up our work, you know, we're sort of getting offered money to like do gigs and this sort of stuff. And then what your mum said to me, like, oh, you don't want to do that, like, you know, you want to get a proper job and you want to make sure you've got constant money coming in. He was like, okay, looked at Nick's dad, he was like, you'll go for it.
So he's like,
cheers, dad.
Cheers, dad. You always rely on dad.
So we went for that one.
Yeah, gave up her jobs. Yeah. And then didn't have a job again for about 20 years.
Yeah, that's kind of good though, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, good. That's a moment where if you hadn't have done that, you'd probably look back on and be like, actually, we had a real opportunity there.
Yeah. We've never really sort of planned to do anything, have we? Like, how did you get into music? We've just been into it, and then you have an idea, and we just sort of tend to just done it.
But I think that's where experience comes into it, because I think my dad did have that chance, and he did regret it. So he was like, he had the knowledge to kind of pass that on.
Yeah.
You know.
And live vicariously through you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. No risk to him.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
But yeah, then we signed to ZTT,
yeah.
And then they started
fucking about with everything,
releasing the singles. So I mean, 1991, because we finished the Frequency album in 89 and released it in 1990, and then they started releasing our music. We signed to them in 1990, November I think. So then first releases came out in January, February, and we literally released five singles that year. So 91 was busy.
Banging, yeah.
Busy. So.
And they were all from Frequency as well?
No.
We'd remix?
Three of them were. And then the other two we wrote that year.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, Sound of Eden.
Yeah, I mean, I want to talk about that one specifically. I mean, that's like a timeless classic. It's still a big sing-along track. It's, you know, a touchstone for everyone of a certain age in this era, yeah. And even people even younger and older.
Yeah.
It's probably an urban legend, but I swear I've read somewhere that the vocalist, was it a lady you met in a cafe, a waitress or something?
Yeah, Jo, yeah.
Yeah, no way.
Yeah, well, we knew Jo anyway.
Yeah.
Because she was in the dance scene anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we needed a vocalist, and she delivered. I think we did do another track with her as well, but that didn't come out due to a sample clearance that we couldn't get cleared. Yeah, I did see her on a YouTube site going, "Foo's slagging us up." So yeah, they didn't. I haven't heard from them. They didn't get back to me, something like that. But I've never had any beef with Jo. She's a lovely girl.
No, so. I kind of get a viewpoint from her perspective. Maybe it looks like we sort of used her for the song and then just pissed off and went about our business. But we didn't really have a lot of use for her sound of her vocals or what we was doing at the time. Yeah. It wasn't like a singing voice that we was looking for at the time, but it worked amazingly well at the beginning. So that would have been good.
I mean, we were learning all the while as well. We had no business management skills at all. You know, we were all of a sudden employing dancers and
live engineers and sound engineers. Yeah.
And, you know, you got to learn as you go along. So apologies, Joe.
Apologies, Joe.
I mean, what was the kind of inspiration behind that track? Was it just something that...
So that was a guy called Ziggy, who actually managed the Prodigy first off, before Mike Champion. But before then, you know, he used to go to the same school as us. So he was thinking of putting on a rave, this was before Prodigy and Shade, called The Garden of Eden. And he came round and he said, like, is it possible to write a track for that? So I think I put some pianos and strings together and came up with a track called Sound of Eden. But it didn't sound anything like the one that everybody knows. So that got released on our first album, was ZTT. And then did we get asked to remix it by ZTT, or we just decided to?
We did a version like we do, got us all together, got in the studio.
We were just on it, and all of a sudden,
this
version of Sound of Eden came out, didn't it? Ray and I had written some amazing lyrics. You put some amazing samples sort of in between, and
it was one of those. Well, what happened was, it was an instrumental, and ZTT said, this needs to be a vocal version, and we were like,
needs to be more catchy.
It doesn't, trust us, this is it, this is it. It doesn't need touching. They're like, nah, trust us, you need to put vocals on this. And we were like, all right, we'll give it a go, but you know, it was almost like, we're going to prove you wrong. We're going to prove you wrong. And we went in the studio, and after about 6 hours, we came up with that. I don't think we ever told them that they were right. It just became ours.
And did you realise at that time that you got something quite special, or did you have a feeling? Or
obviously, you're loving it when you're doing. You sort of get that feeling, you're like, yeah, this is brilliant. But that's only your feeling. To actually, you know, think about other people thinking the same is a completely different thing. We loved it.
Yeah, but you've always got that doubt as well, you know, that kind of, is it too vocally, you know, is it too housey, is it too breakbeat, you know, and sometimes you can overthink things. It's best to just let other people judge that, I think.
Yeah. You know, obviously with the sing-along element of it, have there ever been any, like, special moments playing it live or anything like that that really stand out in your mind? Or
most weekends.
Oh, yeah, there's been some spectacular moments when it's been played. But then, like, you see posts of other people, you know, weddings and funerals and, you know, people have lost people, and it's really meant a lot to that person. So, yeah, it's been really good. It's good to read the comments every now and again on YouTube. There's some quite recent ones on there that are pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's what blows us away, just how personal people think it is to them, you know, which is great, you know, because that's what music does, doesn't it? It captures a moment, I think, for people.
Yeah. We've always been quite emotive in all of our music, haven't we? It's got to get you somehow.
Electronic soul.
Did you have an appearance on Top of the Pops back in 91? I spoke to a few people who have had similar experiences. What was your Top of the Pops experience like?
We got asked to leave the studio because our costumes were too bright. Diana Ross was getting put off. Diana Ross's security said, can you get that ultraviolet threesome out of the studio? I can't sing properly.
Yeah, it was great, wasn't it? It was just like hilarious, sort of fun for us. Just the concept of being asked to go on Top of the Pops, something that you would watch like religiously for years. So that was amazing. But the reality of it, we were stuck in a dressing room like all day, like about 8 of us, something like that, just doing nothing. Eventually, you know, every now and again we'd go for a walk to the canteen or into the studio to get removed.
Try and sneak a peek into Simply Red's dressing room.
Oh yeah, there was a stench coming out of there. Yeah, don't know what that was.
Who were your compatriots on the show that night? Was it Diana? You mentioned Diana Ross and Simply Red. Can you remember anyone else?
Andy Bell was on there, actually, another Peterborough lad, yeah. And funny enough, Cola Boy, another Peterborough lad, he was on the week before as well. So it was a weird time. Yeah, it was a strange time. Diana Ross, KLF. Yeah, the weird thing is, though, it never really transferred, you know. The records were massive. We were playing, you know, that weekend we'd probably played to 20,000 people in a field. And then you come on and try and recreate that on a television screen with no keyboards plugged in, because, you know, that's the way they do it, you know. Is I found it really uncomfortable.
Oh, it's hideous.
Yeah, I found it really uncomfortable. And then, you know, but you need that experience to kind of form you into what you then want to do.
I mean, you mentioned Prodigy as well, and like during that era, I suppose there was a whole circuit of like these great dance music acts, obviously like yourselves, Prodigy, Enjoy, K-Class, these kinds of guys. Did you feel like you were part of a tribe and a real movement at that time, or did you just want to turn up and play the gig and enjoy yourselves?
I don't know, you didn't even think about that really. Obviously we met Liam and Keith, and like obviously Keith is Maxim's from Peterborough anyway, and Leroy. So he was actually stood in a field at somewhere like Energy or somewhere like that, a rave, big rave that was pretty close to us. And I'm standing in the crowd with the Prodigy, and we're looking at Enjoy like performing, and we're thinking, oh, they're great. And then all of a sudden you think, yeah, well, perhaps we should do that now. And it was just like that, but no real sort of
I think
mental thing going, oh yeah, we're going to be the biggest band.
No, not as in a band, but I think where it really was special was they were in the rave scene, we were in the rave scene.
Yeah, the whole rave scene.
Thousands of other people were in the rave scene. So it wasn't we're in a band, it was like we're in this scene, you know. And I think that's, people sort of say what was special about it. I think it was just that sense of everybody together, we're doing something, we're sort of kicking back a bit, and we're all sticking together and doing it together.
I think all the acts sort of hit the ground pretty much at the same time, didn't they? And like I was saying at the beginning of the interview about our record collections, you know, Liam was into all his stuff and he had his sampler, and then he was sampling his collection, and we all kind of hit the ground at the same time.
And you'd all get it, I suppose. You'd all recognise, like, if Liam used a sample there, you'd probably know what it was and be like, oh, right, and, you know, that kind of spurs you on in that way.
Yeah, well, I mean, he did sample Homicide, which, you know, was a huge compliment, you know. And of course, Keaty went... I went to college with Keaty for a short period. I always remember Mr. Virtue said, you either take your cap off or you go home. And he just walked out, picked his bag up, walked out, and the next time I saw him, he's on stage at Nebworth. So, Mr. Virtue did him a favour.
And thinking back to the rave scene, it was almost anti-establishment, like you say, like kind of kicking back against the system and being part of this huge tribe and movement. Do you think something like that could kind of happen again, or do you think the way things are, it's very fragmented and it's too niche, a lot of things that people are into? Or because a lot of people now kind of look, you know, younger people who are into their music, dance music, will look back on that era and be like, I want to relive those days, and would they ever come again?
There was a lot of moments that collided at the same time for that to happen.
Yeah,
I mean, a good diet, there's the music, there's the drugs.
Samplers just came out. All of a sudden, you didn't have to be a musician to start making people dance, you know. But I think the biggest thing is, what people don't realise is, it wasn't just a going out on a Saturday night. It was literally 24 hours a day. You lived it, you know.
Yeah, we spent the first few months like doing gigs, didn't we? And then sort of came back to Peterborough for a few days. Went round one of her mates, and there's just like, you know, 20, 30 people in her living room. We're like, all right. What are you doing? It's like Wednesday night. We're like, yeah, not got work. Nobody's working. Everybody's like giving it their jobs. They're just there, just listening to music.
And I think that was the biggest difference to anything else I've seen. I mean, you think of any big scene and they're living it 24/7, you know.
Yeah.
So it's hard, you know.
Unemployment was probably high then as well.
Yeah. You know, you got Margaret Thatcher's doing a thing, you know, so it was just timing is essential with these things.
Yeah, it's a summer of love, so whenever that will be again, no idea.
So getting back to your point, I don't think you can just, I'm going to go out Saturday night, and it's not, you're going to have a great time and, you know, great experience, but it is slightly different to living it 24/7, you know, that whole scene. You know, you've got to have the right clothes, music, record shops. You've got the trendsetters in every little town who are kind of really important, the tastemakers. And then you've got, like, I think the most important thing is having a place where people can meet. So all like-minded people would then go to Miss Pears in Peterborough. So every town's got their own little place. And so, you know, if you were going out, you'd always go there. And then you'd hear, oh, there's a rave in Cambridge. Everybody in the cars, everybody go to Cambridge. You don't know what you're doing. I remember once we drove an hour to Cambridge, waited 2 hours in the car park at Cherry Hinton. First car pulls out, we start following it.
All down the country roads.
All down these country roads. 2 hours later, we're back in Peterborough. the rave's here. So like 5 hours later, we're back where we started and we're in Fengate in a warehouse. It didn't matter though. It was like, that was part of that day, so.
And how far afield will you go into these kind of raves and things? And
anywhere.
Yeah.
Absolutely anywhere.
Yeah.
We'd get back from raves and then, like, go to Brighton to a free party or something like that. Yeah. In the forest.
Yeah, or go to Wales because there's something in a old abandoned railway tunnel or something like that, you know.
Brilliant days.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did have its dark moments as well, though. A lot of people don't talk about the dark moments, but, you know, there was a lot of dark moments as well.
There was, yeah. Nothing that good can last.
Yeah, and there was, I've interviewed Terry Farley for this, and he made it, one of the points I always remember that he made was, you know, everyone always talks about the good times and the good things, and you see the videos and the photos, and everyone looks like it looks amazing. It was like sometimes, you know, like you say, the party was 5 hours away, and it was back circle back to where you were, and you turn up, and everyone's like on a downer, and, you know, those are the ones that people don't talk about.
Yeah, it turns into selective memory, and then you just remember the good ones. But yeah, there was loads of bad ones where the music was just getting too fast. It was like the middle of winter and it's like really cold and muddy. And yeah.
I remember Amnesia House, Donington Park, and the gig had finished. It was about 6 in the morning and I'd just started packing my keyboards away and I'd just coiled a cable, about to put it in the flight case, and all of a sudden I just felt like I was going to just
suffocate.
Pass out. I couldn't breathe at all. Yeah, I just couldn't breathe. I couldn't get any air in my lungs. And I looked around. Looked at Lance, and he looked okay. and then literally seconds later, he looked the same as I did. And somebody had let this CS gas off under the stage, and there was loads of competition between rival promoters and, you know, whatever else went on back then. You know, so yeah, there was some weird moments as well. Yeah.
I mean, over the past 5 or 10 years, there's been like this real resurgence of events. I mean, we mentioned before that mics on like Clockwork Orange and Clockstock and stuff like that, where, you know, it's almost catering to that market. Someone like myself who's got a bit more disposable income now, and my kids are a bit older, and I can go out and party again and, you know, enjoy all the music as it was. And sometimes you see parents there with their kids and stuff like that. I mean, obviously you've been involved in some of that. What have your experience been?
It's been getting really good again, the club scene, for the last sort of 3 years or so. Quality of music, the crowds that are turning up, they're all into it, properly invested. Like you say, we're sort of doing gigs now that are for, you know, average age of 40 and 50, and, you know, the Ibiza, Slipmouth's Ibiza, slip back in time things. Been there 3 years on the trot. They've been really good, really great people.
Yeah, is it bringing back a lot of faces from?
Yeah, they've all got the same ethos.
Yeah,
and obviously they've got kids. Our generation has got kids, and we're starting to see them sort of doing music that's influenced by their parents.
Yeah, I mean the Ibiza week is probably the closest you've come to that community feeling that was back then, you know, because you're in two hotels right next to each other, you're all going to the same gigs, you're meeting people, you know, because that's what it's all about. It's like people all over the country meeting people for the first time and swapping stories and, you know.
It's friendly, relaxed.
Yeah, just nobody's a dick.
You see, like the second year we played there, it was at Ibiza Rocks. Yeah. You know, it's a good venue, but it hasn't really got that homely vibe. But the Slipmat thing was brilliant. But then I think the week after, it was like Radio 1's sort of weekend, and it's, you know, Stormzy and Wiley and all that lot there. It must be a completely different atmosphere compared to what we're doing. But like Nick said, it's a different venue now. It's really nice.
Yeah, I mean, Ibiza's just a lovely island, and it's got so many. Some people think it's this one thing, but it's not. It's all these things.
Yeah, so. I wouldn't go to Ibiza normally, I don't think. We did some great parties in Spain, didn't we? When we first started gigging. God, they was mental. Motorbikes through the crowds, fire eaters, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
And how different have the scenes been from the different places that you've travelled around playing? Is there anything that really kind of stands out as totally crazy?
We used to have the south-north divide when we was gigging, so like, you know, a lot more sort of pianos up north and a lot darker down south and more beats.
Yeah, it used to be like 4-4 up north and then kind of breakbeat down south.
Yeah. Up north, the crowd would be like, yeah! And then down south, they'd be like that.
But I think that's why Sound of Eden kind of worked as well, because we were doing, it had a kick in it, 4-4 kick, but it also had a breakbeat as well. So we could kind of traverse the scenes a little bit, because it was literally like rave was split in half back then.
Yeah.
In the early 90s, it was like it was split in half. Nowadays, old school is both of those musics.
Yeah.
But back then, it'd be kind of, you know, you had your down the south, would be playing break beats and bass lines, and up north would be more housey. So
yeah, it's interesting to make that distinction. I mean, like you say, Sound of Eden's got kind of both, a bit of both elements. It's got that break beat and it's got the pianos.
Yeah,
it's kind of overlooked in the sense that there were different sounds in different parts of the country.
Yeah. And the pianos were really quite a northern thing to start with as well, wasn't they? We found when we was gigging.
Yeah, we'd have to do a different set, But now everybody's happy.
It just moved so quickly, though. You know, from the early raves of 88, 89, where it was, you know, house music, it was hip-hop, it was even a little bit of indie you'd hear as well, in the raves as well. So a rave back then was really varied. You'd have Groove Rider and Sasha back-to-back. Not back to back, next to each other, playing sets next to each other, and they'd be playing a similar set. You know, you wouldn't think the music's changed here. You know, so.
Yeah, you see those names on the flyer and you think, how can that even be?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's incredible breadth of real melting pot.
Yeah.
Yeah. But what we always do is get our guests to choose 5 tracks for a Spotify playlist that we do. And then obviously, we've done like, you know, 20 interviews or whatever so far, so it's quite a big list of really random stuff in places, but all quality. And the themes are, you know, the catalyst, what first got you into dance music, house music, whatever, and we'll kind of go from there. So I wrote them down for you if you just want to remember what they are. But what we always try and do is just get a bit of a thumbnail sketch about your experience with these tracks and why have they made it onto this list. So
I was going to put that and I didn't. And then I was listening to Trevor Mack, I always say Trevor Mack, Trevor Nelson. And he played it on his show.
When today?
Yeah. Well, last night.
Oh, really?
it's quality. So the catalyst, what would that be?
Yeah, Funkmasters. Well, going back to the school disco on a Friday, that's where we first heard it. Friday dinner time.
So those 5th years have been playing it then?
Yeah, the 5th years were playing it. And not only that, I think, because the chemistry teacher used to give the 5th years, you know, £20 to go out and buy some tunes. So back then it used to be like television workshops used to sell records, sell vinyl. So you'd go in a television shop and out the back they'd have like vinyl. And there was a 12-inch of Love Money. And whenever this came on, the whole school had a little dance routine for it. So I can still remember it now. It's a good job this is a podcast. But yeah. Yeah, it was amazing tune, jazz funk tune, but it was just where it was starting to go electronic. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Have you ever sampled it in any of your stuff? Or?
No.
Is that too much?
I think it's we've sampled Atmosphere, Dancing in Outer Space, and that was kind of similar vibe. It was that jazz funk, but going into
Brandon Block chose that one.
Yeah, classic. Yeah. I mean, the hi hats on there. That's what we sampled. We sampled just the hi hats on there.
And so let's move on to a floor filler.
Nice.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a hard one because every floor is different.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've probably got a whole box of floor fillers.
Yeah.
Certain tracks that will move a crowd, though, all the same way, isn't it?
For me, this ticks all the boxes, though, because DJ Zinc, 138 Trek, it's kind of just drums and bass line. That's all it is, with a fill. But everybody loves it, you know. It's got the hip hop feel, it's got a rave feel to it, it's
lovely,
got
swing
drum and bass feel to
it's almost drum and bass.
Yeah, it's just one of my favourite records, and it's one of the simplest records, you know.
It's fantastic. I'm getting a bit of goosebumps just thinking about it. I love that track. It's great to see it come through on and yeah, we got there in the end, but a choice for a sunsetter.
Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, there's obviously a lot of sunsetters, but this one takes us back to Ibiza. We'd done a gig over there. We had like a few days chilling, and we watched the sunset outside Cafe Mambo. And just as it was going down, they put that on. And I'm glad I had my sunglasses on because it just broke me. Just seriously broke me. So, yeah, that's my sunset.
It's the corgis everybody's got to learn sometime.
Everybody's got to learn sometime, yeah.
And it's got, I mean...
And obviously, you know... Baby D, you know, they did a version, so it's a bit ravey as well.
Yeah, I think that sample in it, I was only ever familiar with the sample before I'd even heard that one when I was like growing up. So discovering where the original came from was
totally
quite something when I was like about 12, you know.
Yeah, sun going down Ibiza totally just made me melt.
Yeah, it's gorgeous, gorgeous. And well, yeah, moving on to a tearjerker.
Oh, no, I picked Chaosmos, Looped. Just because it's just my kind of thing, and I'm a sucker for a string and a piano moving in a certain way. So yeah, that'll put a lump in my throat, definitely. But millions of them. Yeah, I love sort of emotive stuff. I mean, if we probably didn't work together, I'd probably just be putting out wrist cutting tunes. Like, that'd be my entire collection. Just all in minor keys.
I think everybody's, you know, it's about the mood, isn't it, that you're in. If you're on a downer, had a bad day, then trying to write an upbeat, happy song is going to be hard, isn't it? So, last tune, that's hard. Again, you know, so many different dance floors. So, but we thought we'd go for a classic on that, Joe Smooth, Promised Land. It's just such an uplifting tune to end on. Yeah. You know, it's just probably one of the most mood-enhancing tracks you'll ever hear, you know. So
it's brilliant watching all the crowd singing it.
Yeah.
And it's just, you can feel that rush that you used to get when you was back raving, doing things that you shouldn't have done.
And the lyrics still resonate now, really.
They do, yeah. And I loved the way the sound ping-ponged across the Atlantic as well. Mm-hmm. So you'd have like Detroit, Chicago, and then it'd come over here, and there'd be like the acid house would turn into like a British version, and then it'd go rave, and then it'd go back over to America, and then there's this constant ping-pong taking influences from what they'd just added to it, you know. And that was really early on. You know, one of the originators. Yeah,
so cool. And to kind of wrap it up, I suppose we always ask, obviously we're house culture, you guys have been part of the fabric of it since the beginning, what does the whole scene kind of mean to you, and what has it brought to you in your life so far?
Obviously very proud to be part of it. We've always wanted to be into music, so
I think we're surprised as well. We're surprised that
the longevity
get a reaction. Yeah, surprised we're still here. Struggling, not gigging, because we've been gigging for literally 30 years. So this is, with the lockdown, this is the first time we've not gigged for nearly four months, which is really, really strange.
Yeah, have you done anything virtually?
Yeah, we've done a couple virtually, but again, it's so hard being in your room on your own. I mean, we did it with three of us, so we were all in our individual rooms.
It was so really good. It took a lot of work, didn't it?
Yeah.
But then actually, sort of watching it play back on a Saturday night, it was for a street rave up in Scotland. Yeah. And it's really good. Got quite a buzz off it, just being involved in it when it was actually played live.
There's been some good ones. It's definitely seen me through it, you know, watching some good sets.
Do you think it'll be... I don't think there will be, but do you think there would be like a move towards maybe doing things a bit more virtually, or do you think everyone would just be happy to get back out there?
If they can monetize it,
yeah,
because you know you're not getting paid anything really if you do it at the moment. Yeah. But yeah, if they was saying X amount for this,
my only concern would be it's a great opportunity for certain politicians to prevent this from going back to clubbing for a long while. You know, we almost played a drive-through gig in a couple of weeks, but the local council pulled it, saying even though people are in this square in their car, they could be shouting to other people and that could transmit it. I mean, there's always going to be a risk. It's just we've got to just limit the risk, but without stopping people partying, because you're not going to stop people partying. That's why people are doing illegal stuff, because they can't do it legally. You're never going to stop people partying.
That's probably a great place to wrap up, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, mate.
House culture.
Nice one. I hope you all enjoyed that. How inspiring was it to hear about the do-it-yourself attitude of that era? All you needed for success was good musical taste, some motivation, a few bits of equipment, and a fair bit of fearlessness. I hope the words from Shades of Rhythm can inspire you on whatever you're working on right now. I also want to say a personal thanks to Nick and Lanx for meeting me at social distance over lockdown. The whole thing was organised like some kind of illegal party, with locations for meets being shared by Google Maps pin drops on WhatsApp. Who said those types of parties couldn't happen again, eh? If you want to hear the Shades of Rhythm submissions for our Perfect playlist, please open up your Spotify player, search for House Culture Perfect Playlist, and there you'll find not only Nick and Lanx's submissions, but choices from every guest we've had on both seasons of the podcast so far. There's all kinds of stuff in there covering every facet of house music culture and more, so give it a shuffle and turn it up loud. Once you're listening to that, please help support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, and rating or reviewing us on Apple. Please, it's really important. It does make a difference, so get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. If you say something nice enough, we'll give you a mention on a future episode. This time around, the lucky listener is someone who goes by the name of The Glazer. They left us a review on Apple Podcasts saying that they have been listening to these episodes whilst doing the school run in Ibiza. It's made them realise why they ended up living there. Amazing stuff. We at House Culture are ecstatic that we can continually inspire you about your chosen home of the White Isle. I hope you stay tuned in for the massive guests we have coming up in the future as well. And if you want to join us as House Culture from wherever you might be in the world, please hit up our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet or follow the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. Not only will you be fully informed about the podcast, you'll also get connected with other house music lovers from across the world. And finally, if you want to get in touch with me, Matt Rouse, you can do it directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening, stay safe, and see you next time.
House culture.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus,
Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.